From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, I'm Paris Halston. Welcome to Consider This from Boston, where one city councilor is making the push to examine reparations for Black residents. This comes as several other cities and towns across the country are having a similar conversation. WBUR's Daryl C. Murphy has been reporting on this and joins us now. Hey, Daryl, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this conversation has been everywhere in recent years. But to give us some context, why are reparations being considered here in Boston now?
Yeah, so this goes back to slavery, which was an institution in America before the country was founded. And Boston was a hub for the slave trade since back in the 1600s. In fact, the first documented enslaved Africans arrived here in 1638, very early days in terms of North American colonization. And, you know, even while Massachusetts outlawed slavery in 1783, Black people have been treated as second-class citizens ever since, despite making significant contributions to their communities. And this discrimination continues through today as the city's Black communities lag behind in areas like wealth, education, and health. And, you know, if you remember, a 2015 report from the Boston Fed found non-immigrant Black households in Boston, they have a median net worth of $8 compared to white households with a median net worth of more than $200,000. And while the study's authors admit the sample size was pretty small, the contrast remains incredibly stark. Yvette Modestin of the National African-American Reparations Commission, known as NARC, puts it this way.
We don't have the chains around our ankles and our hands anymore, but there is a chain still there.
Oh, well, that's quite the metaphor.
Yeah, and part of the conversation about reparations is, you know, addressing that, lifting those chains and trying to make things right. So City Councilor Julia Mejia is leading an effort within the City Council to establish a commission that would examine this history and see what might be done to rectify it.
We're going to talk about that in a second. But as we mentioned, this is happening nationally as well.
Yeah, so a thing that's giving the reparations movement a lot of momentum is a proposed legislation in the U.S. House called H.R. 40, which also calls for a commission to study slavery and its impacts and suggest a reparations plan. Now, that bill is very likely to fail, but places like Amherst, Cambridge, San Francisco, Asheville, North Carolina, they've begun some sort of reparations initiative to address the historic harm done to Black people in those communities. And earlier this year, Evanston, Illinois, enacted what is regarded as the first reparations program for a U.S. city. Evanston is using $400,000 from a $10 million reparations fund to offer housing grants to Black residents who meet certain residency requirements. So this program would give applicants up to $25,000 for purchase of a home, renovations, or mortgage assistance. Now, if you do the math, you know, if you gave $25,000 to each recipient in the Evanston program, that's just 16 people. And this program was not met with unanimous enthusiasm from Evanston residents. I spoke with the alderwoman Cicely Fleming of Evanston, who was the only dissenting vote against the program. Basically, she told me she thinks it's not really reparations, but it's more of a housing program. And, you know, it's only available to a select few residents.
So maybe not quite what people are looking for.
Right. You know, reparations is a big concept, you know, and I got to say, I even thought to myself that a program like Evanston, where you're giving, you know, a housing grant instead of, you know, just direct payments, it kind of ties the recipient to the town. It's not true freedom. Right. And it's not, you know, I guess I had to ask, is that really reparations? Are you giving this person agency to make the decision for whether they want to stay in the town or go somewhere else? You know, because you don't give people that freedom to use the funds as they see fit, there's something kind of patronizing about it.
Yeah, I see. So would Boston be doing something a little different?
I would say yes. I think that's the purpose of the commission, is to get a group established that's going to do the research, the interviews, have the hearings, and, you know, get the necessary information together so that they can make a decision on the best way forward. You know, sure, Evanston did their thing, but that's a city of 75,000 people. You know, Boston, one of the oldest cities in the country, 600,000 people. I spoke with Tanisha Sullivan, president of the NAACP Boston branch, one of the local organizations pushing for the commission.
yes, this is a federal issue, and nationally we need to wrestle with and reckon with the issue of our history, but there's also work that can be done at the local level. We don't have to wait for the federal government to take action.
I think it's safe to say that the people who are behind us, they're approaching this with a sense of putting something together that fits Boston.
So to that point, how is the effort in Boston unfolding?
Well, Mejia is working with local organizers and activists, including Sullivan, to make this happen. Right now, Mejia is working on the ordinance she hopes to pass next year in time for the budget hearings. There was a hearing about reparations that Mejia hosted back in October, which Sullivan sees as a victory in itself.
For the very first time, we are building a structure around which a record can be established.
So is this gaining any traction? I mean, could we see some movement on this anytime soon?
You know, for Boston specifically, it may be too early to tell how the city as a whole responds, since the effort at this level is just getting started. But nationally, it is definitely gaining traction, as we have seen in other places, even in Massachusetts, Amherst, Cambridge. So that could be an indicator for what to expect as this effort continues.
Well, we'll be looking forward to following along with you as things go from here. That's WBUR reporter Daryl C. Murphy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Before we go, I should tell you what else is up. Governor Charlie Baker says he expects a state-sanctioned COVID vaccination passport program to be implemented in Massachusetts and several other states in the near future. He says a scannable QR code would verify a person's vaccination status.
We've been working with a bunch of other states, there's probably 15 or 20 of them, to try to create a single QR code that can be used for all sorts of things.
Last week, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu hinted that the city may also move to implement a vaccine mandate for businesses like restaurants and performance venues. In other news, retailers who are banking on a busy holiday shopping season are hoping that the new Omicron variant doesn't affect in-person sales. John Hurst, head of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts, had predicted a 6% increase in holiday sales over last year, but he says he's concerned.
It just seems like the goalposts keep on moving, don't they? You know, we've been at this now for, what, about 20 months, and it's been difficult.
But Hurst admits that the retailers he visited on Black Friday and so-called Small Business Saturday reported a sizable increase in gift purchases compared to last year. Meantime, the Massachusetts Parole Board is facing a lawsuit claiming it's not following the state law that allows the board to terminate someone's parole. The suit says that in the past 6 years, nearly 50 people have filed petitions to have their parole ended, but only two have had their request approved. Criminal defense attorney Eric Tenen says the board has onerous policies that make terminating parole difficult.
The legislature envisioned that there might come a point in the lifespan of a parolee where they no longer require parole supervision. And so if that statute is there, it's because we believe that at some point, even though that was your sentence, it's just no longer in the interest, in the public interest to supervise you.
The state says it does not comment on pending litigation. The parole board is expected to respond to the suit in the coming weeks. And finally, traveling circuses could soon be barred from displaying certain animals like lions, tigers, and bears in Massachusetts. State Representative Lori Ehrlich is backing a bill on the issue.
We've seen significant momentum across the Commonwealth to end the use of animals in circuses and other live acts, either by voluntary action by circus operators or through municipal action. But we have failed to step up to the plate as a state.
Advocates say the treatment of animals in traveling shows is often inhumane. But Gene Cassidy, head of the Big E Fair in Western Massachusetts, says he thinks Ehrlich's bill goes too far.
Abuse of animals is bad, whether they are exotic or domestic, and it should never be permitted under any circumstance. However, this bill goes far beyond prohibiting abusive behavior, and it seeks to prohibit the mere exhibition of well-cared-for animals.
The bill would not apply to animals in permanent zoos. So, I'd like to hear from y'all on this. Do you think animals are better off in captivity or in the wild, especially if they're endangered? Send us a text at 617-272-7346 with your thoughts. That's 617-272-7346. From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, the greatest combo since the animal kingdom and humans fighting to preserve it, I'm Paris Alston. Be well. Hey there! A lot of people listen to Consider This at the end of the day, and NPR's up first in the morning. But a lot of the actual news happens in the middle of the day. And the team bringing the best information about that news as it happens is the team behind WBUR and NPR's show Here and Now. And yes, there is a podcast version. So want more of the best news reporting from public radio around the country? Check out Here and Now. Find it in the same place you found this podcast, wherever you listen. Just search Here and Now.